So you guys know that I'm putting the wrong tapes up, right? So that people who don't come to class get bad information?
A couple of pieces of administrative. I will not be here on Wednesday. I'm doing minor oral surgery tomorrow, and while I could in principle be at Hopkins on Wednesday, it's not likely I could talk for an hour. For most of you, that's probably a welcome reprieve. I will not be here next week, but there will be class. Swaroop Sridhar is going to spend next week talking about virtual machines, and he's done some work on dynamic translation himself that's interesting and relevant stuff.
Will Swaroop be teaching on the 12th on Wednesday?
Sorry?
Will Swaroop be teaching on Wednesday?
No. No. So Wednesday, we're not meeting. Next week, Swaroop's going to cover virtual machines. I'm down at a workshop actually here in Baltimore, but it works out that if I do class and drive down, I miss it all. So, what else? Also, I want to call your attention to a glitch in the syllabus. At some point, I did some delightful edit, whose effect was that I rotated the last 2 weeks. So right now it says, well, I'm going to do exam review, and then I'm going to do last week time to make capability systems, and then we have the break before exams, the calm before the storm, the window of leeway in which to panic. And obviously I'm not going to do that, do the review at the end. Midterms are graded. I need to look at them, but I expect I'll be coming back in the next day or two. I reserve the right, if I'm too doped up from surgery, not to send out incomprehensible email concerning midterms. So, it might be Wednesday. I don't see there's any win sending out email that neither of us can understand what it says when it's over, right? The only issues we had on the projects were one group was a week late getting it working, and I have to figure out what to do about that. And a second thing, and this is something that almost everybody ran into. The assignment was very clear in the slab allocator assignment that you could not use malloc. The whole point was you were replacing malloc. Almost all of the people who used an AVL tree implementation allowed it to call malloc. That's no good. We're going to have to figure out what to do about that since we didn't call it out as something we were going to assign specific points to. It's a does not meet requirements issue. And obviously we're not going to go overboard with it. I just want you to know that this was sort of missed the point. Okay. So the topic for this week is protection and access control and, loosely speaking, security. I'm not going to spend a lot of energy on the security part. I want to sort of roll by that because, frankly, most of the issues that arise in security, the way most people use the term, aren't operating system issues. Let me give you an example. When you ask people, give me a laundry list of things that in your mind are security issues, right? They'll come up with, invariably, I mean, they may come up with a lot of things, but the things they come up with will certainly include password protection, intrusion detection, virus resistance. Now, cryptography, right, this is a security topic in people's minds. Cryptography is not an operating system. Password protection is also not an operating system issue, except in the very limited sense that you can build some policies into your password tools that help people choose less bad passwords. It turns out there are roughly no good passwords because human beings cannot use effective passwords. They can't remember them. You can build policies in your system that say, look, you can't even get to the authentication agent unless we already know you're coming in over an encrypted channel, so then at least we know your password isn't crossing the wire in the clip. Probably a good thing. You don't want your password crossing the wire in the clip. But if you look at that pragmatically and you ask what's going on in the wild,
Okay? Hopkins makes a big thing about protecting your password, right? And then if you look at the protocols that we deploy, those protocols, many of them either ship your password in the clear or bypass your password altogether, like NFS. Right? The NFS protection model is client machine talks to server machine. Client machine alleges to server machine that the client has authenticated you. And the client and the server either directly agree on a numerical assignment of what it means to be you, a little number, which is your user ID, or the server implements some kind of a mapping table from client IDs to server IDs so that it can do a translation. Okay? But the fundamental step in there is the server passes the buck to the client without any kind of validation and then trusts what the client says. Your password was nowhere in sight. There's absolutely nothing to stop me from walking into the computer lab with a CD, right, booting Knoppix, which gives me root access to everything, adding a user account for you, right, firing up an NFS link to the departmental server, and doing anything I want with your documents. Right? The only thing that stops me from doing that is that Steve actually watches the cameras in the lab. So good, don't do it in the lab. Right? Do it over the wireless link. From the hallway. And this is Steve. And in Steve's defense, because I've actually pointed out many of these vulnerabilities to him, and some of the particular ones I just mentioned may have been closed. Oh, and there's more. It gets better. But let me finish defending Steve since I started that. So it's not that Steve is an idiot. He's not an idiot at all. He's well aware of these issues. He views them with great pain. But there is no network file system widely available today that actually solves this problem. And there's absolutely no network file system anywhere that approaches this problem of authentication correctly. It's not crazy for the server to trust the client in this regard, provided the server knows what the client is. Not based on its network card number, not based on its TCP IP number, based on knowing what software and what algorithms it ran. And starting to ship now, starting to ship over the last couple of years, and it seems to have dropped off in interest, but there is a technology that lets us do that with reasonable confidence. Reasonable confidence means give me $10,000 and the opportunity to install a PCI card and I can beat it. But that's more of an impediment than most of us are willing to take on to crack our neighbor's passwords in an academic setting. And so one of the things that you need to sort of look at here, so I've mentioned authentication. Authentication means figuring out whether the user at the keyboard is entitled to access the programs that they are using. And notice I did not say the data that those programs are accessing. That's a determination you have to make based on the programs. The user's authentication stops at the edge of the box. Right? It determines if the user can talk across the box boundary. Once you're inside the box, the user performs no actions. Programs then perform actions. Hopefully, on behalf of the user, although I have more to say about that. To compound Steve's problem, we have legacy issues in the Hopkins network. You may not know this. There's a policy at Hopkins. This is a really stupid policy because not only can they not enforce it, they can't even detect it. That says, you may not sniff packets on the Hopkins network. Please explain to me how, over a wireless network using broadcast radio, anybody can detect the fact that you're running TCP dump on the privacy of your own laptop. Now, why? Do they care? I actually had a long fight with the Hopkins networking people the year I got here. I said, look, we can't characterize how bad the problem is without collecting data. And in order to analyze that data reproducibly, we need to record it. To which the Hopkins networking people replied,
we can't let you do that. I said, this is an academic institution. We don't suppress research. They said, we do when medical liability is involved. I said, what do you mean? Well, we have two problems. Number one, we have protocols in use that use clear text passwords. I said, yes, I understand the networking support here is not as competent as we might wish, but that's not a compelling argument. Okay. They said, yes, unfortunately, some of the packets going across the network include medical data because there are people on the Homewood campus collaborating with people on the medical campus, and they're moving patient data back and forth. I said, and that stuff is sent, and you're worried about that stuff being disclosed. They said, yes. I said, you're telling me that stuff is being sent in the clear over a publicly switched network between the campuses. They said, yes. It's a leased line, but they don't understand a leased line is still a publicly switched network these days. I said, you're already in the liability. It's not to do with whether I recorded the data. It's whether you were negligent in its transmission. Well, it depends on what data they send. And no, if the data is being transmitted among people that the patient has given permission to collaborate on in regard to their treatment, they have not violated HIPAA.
But they have to, I'm pretty sure that HIPAA is a secure channel.
HIPAA does not contain specific wording about things like that. HIPAA is a horrible law because it's very imprecise and it's unenforceable, sorry?
Yeah, that's what I just said. It has no teeth. You can't sue.
HIPAA actually is turning out to have some nasty teeth.
You can't sue either the hospital or the doctor if one or the other releases your information. You're left with nobody. At least on that part.
I don't want to get sucked into HIPAA today. There's a view that one could reasonably take in the law that this is an internal transmission within an organization. Okay. And to the extent that the organization credibly believes that it has leased a private line, this data is not leaving the institution, and you're not obligated to encrypt it when you send it from one workstation to another within an institution. You know that, and I know that, but the contract is it's a leased line between the two locations. Okay. The problem is there aren't any such things as leased lines anymore. There haven't been for many, many years. But the worst part is that data is traversing the network that you guys use. Okay? So it turns out the real reason they don't want you snooping the network is they don't want somebody, they're concerned about being exposed to liability. It's not even that they don't want you recording the medical data. There are certainly doctors at Hopkins, right, who care about such things, and indeed they don't want you recording the medical data. They view it as a privacy issue. But that's not the problem from HIT's perspective. From HIT's perspective, the problem is fiduciary liability to the institution. Medical data isn't their job. And that's proper. Right? Their job is moving bits from here to there. And the question is, well, why aren't they encrypting the data? And the answer is, the data is kept on legacy 370 mainframes that don't do SSL. They can't encrypt the data. And at that point, I said, why isn't it on a virtual private network? You know, endpoint encryption failure be damned, you could put this over an encrypted VPN. And you can implement that VPN in software on the client end, you know, and with a hardware bridge box in front of the, you know, apparently uncooperative mainframe. By the way, mainframes do that particular encryption just fine. Well, that would be hard. Take a long time to deploy. Okay, so look, the reason I'm telling the story, let me now defend HITS, right? HITS, like all network support operations, is an organization that operates with about a third of the budget that it needs to do its job. There's only so many brush fires they can put out in a given time. Okay, and this one hasn't hit the top of the things that are burning down list this week. The point I'm trying to make is, talking about security is not a quick fix kind of a problem. There's an entire set of end-to-end ways to hurt yourself, and people do them routinely. Banks routinely have nice firewalls
let me not get started about firewalls, because there's actually no such thing as a firewall that works, behind which they have a modem pool that you can dial up to and get direct access to their internal network. Routine. There are a few banks that try to keep those modem pools off of their networks. Some helpful employee will decide that it would be convenient to call in from home, and they'll set up a modem at their desk. And believe me, there are people war dialing those exchanges looking for those modems. And the banks know it. My personal favorite, since I'm picking on banks, I had the following exchange with Bank of America. I do not use web account management at Bank of America. I refuse. And they're a little annoyed about this, because when a Hopkins computer science professor says, I won't use your banking service, they want to know why. They think, hey, computer science is not like computers. And this might be a case of knowing too much. So I had the following conversation. They want me to use this for business banking. Why? Because they don't want to pay tellers. I had the following conversation with them. I said, you do electronic bill paying? They said, oh, yes, it's a wonderful feature. You can get online, you can pay your bills to whoever you want. I said, good. Can I enter the information for the payee online? Oh, yes, of course. It's terribly convenient, right? You can just enter all the information you need. Wonderful. Can I turn that off? Huh? Well, what you told me is that anybody who manages to obtain my four-digit PIN, which, by the way, is laughably inadequate, can enter the address of absolutely anywhere they want to send my money. And then they can send it there. And then, because this is a commercial account and not a consumer account, we'll then discover that the bank has no insurance obligations for its negligence and incompetence in this strategy, in this situation. To which the bank responded, I said, let me make it clear and let me put it in writing. If you turn this feature on my account, you assume all liability for the consequences, and you're doing it explicitly without my permission. Then they had the same conversation again about the personal account. Now, the really fun part is when I told this story to both of the companies that handle my stock trading accounts, the responses were, oh shit, we got the same problem. Okay? And the thing about stock trading accounts is, you know, when people offload money out of those accounts, the amounts are not measured in tens of dollars. Most people don't keep a lot of cash in their bank account. It doesn't earn that much money there. They put it in the stock market. They put it in bonds, right? So the big money is in the brokerage accounts. I mean, if we're talking about individual funds. Never mind the corporate accounts. All right. So there's an end-to-end problem. And notice that the majority of this problem is not an operating system problem. It's a systemic design and composition problem that actually has to be sort of cared for and nurtured at every step of the way and continuously analyzed, because the users, in the name of convenience, a small fraction of them will successfully work to defeat it. And there's nothing an OS can do about any of that. So, for this reason, I'm actually not very excited about password protection. I work on the assumption that if I really care about, if I've got information on a computer and I really care about whether it's me that's going to get access to it, I got two rules. One, I don't put it on a public computer. I mean, I don't put a network cable on that computer. Removing the plug is just as good. Two, I don't allow logins on that computer. Remember, we went through the exercise of public keys on CS418. CS418 does not permit password-based login in the absence of an SSH key. Now, there's a set of other problems that are still issues on that machine, but at least I don't have to worry about the password problem. How many of you use passwords that you use on other machines in the department on that machine? Okay, you did. I mean, how many of you can remember 15 passwords for 15 different machines? Anybody who raises his hand now is lying. Okay. And every website you go to says, oh, what password do you want to use here, right? And your solution is you hand them all the same one. Or at best, You hand them something where it has the same component, and then you have some modifier at the front, which is based on something at that website. This doesn't scale. Right? The whole scheme doesn't scale. All right, so let's talk about the threats and the issues that an operating system actually might be able to deal with. There's a whole subject area of what's called penetration resistance. It is often alleged that penetration happens, in essence, because people program in C. I'm leaving several steps. But the argument goes, look, the basic methodology of a penetration attack is, I'm going to send some data, right? I'm going to overrun a bound somewhere, and I'm going to cause the receiving program to execute something because I said so, not because it was part of the intended program behavior. And there are a variety of ways to do it. I can send it something that's actually a command string that it executes, right? I can overwrite some critical data variable in it. That one's been done on sendmail countless times. I can send the string and cause it to return into libc and invoke some procedure that it has the authority to invoke, the net effect of which is that it does something it didn't intend to do. Things like this. And all of those problems arise because programs are written in a language that doesn't check input boundaries. And programmers don't check input boundaries. I mean, the issue is not whether C is on the path to code generation. The issue is whether the language that you wrote in supported you or enticed you into error. It's very, very hard to write a program that supports this attack in Java. It's also very, very hard to write a program that's useful at any interesting scale in Java, which is why people use C. Now, there's a real catch-22 there. One of the things we're working on in my lab is, can we come up with a language that's, you know, on the edge of as efficient as C, but still safe? And that remains to be seen. However, so if you look at the demographics of computer crime, you'll discover that about 85% of the attacks that get reported are penetration attacks. Right? The other big attacks that you see popularized are denial of service attacks. So the idea of a denial of service attack, I'm going to come back to penetration in a second. The idea of a denial of service attack is it's not going to try to break in and muck with or steal data. It's rather that I'm trying to make the system unusable. Right? This is a nuisance attack. I'm going to take your server, I'm going to hit it with so many useless packets, it's not going to tell me anything useful, and that's not my goal. I'm going to hit it with so many useless packets, each of which takes some time to deal with, that it will have no time left to actually do what it's supposed to be doing. So the one classic example of this, the TCP protocol says that there's a timeout before you can conclude that the connection has been dropped. And the timeout used to be something like 90 seconds. It was 45, but I think it was 90. It was long. And that was not an unmotivated number. At the time that number was set, end-to-end connections included 1,200 baud modems. You had very long latencies from one end to the other. And, of course, the minute you have a timeout like that, you have an attack. And the attack goes, open a TCP connection. Good, I'm going to walk away. Open a TCP connection. Good, I'm going to walk away. Open a TCP. And the server is sitting there saying, okay, I've got a TCP connection. I'm not allowed to declare it dead for 90 seconds. How fast do you think you can open TCP connections? Now, there's several solutions. One, people shorten the timeout, right? They violated the spec to help make the machine work. Two, people started doing adaptive countermeasures. They said, I'm going to watch where the traffic is coming from, and if I notice that a certain machine is opening connections at the rate of a billion connections a minute, maybe I should just stop listening. Strictly speaking, that's a violation of the spec. That machine's still running. They don't really care if they're violating the spec. The attackers aren't stupid. They know that you're running Windows. They know the only way to make Windows safe is to unplug it. They said, maybe what I should do is instead of sending all these things from one machine, I should send them from all of my neighbor's machines. I could break into my neighbor's machine. It's not that hard. ActiveX, right, the thing that does all that fancy user interface stuff on your browser, it's the most wonderful penetration support tool in existence. Means you go to my website, I own you. And you've got a wonderful slide up, poster up on the third floor, illustrating a company that actually went through the exercise of putting up a plausible view trust content from somebody, I don't remember who the somebody was, right? And it looked exactly like the correct vendor's view trust content from. And the user, of course, what happens when you see, you know, 40 of these boxes, you get into the habit of saying yes, because what the hell else are you going to do? It's not like getting, it's not like saying no will let you proceed in a useful sense. So you get trained to say yes. That's not helpful. But let's assume that was helpful, right? So notice we're already starting with assume false then. So we're already into the dangerous argument. Suppose we're actually going to look at the question, do I trust content from Microsoft? Let's think about that for a second. How many people program for Microsoft? How many zeros is the number? Are we talking about tens, hundreds, thousands? What do you think?
Tens of thousands?
Hundreds of thousands. In fact, probably many. Because the right question to ask is, if I say yes, who are the people I'm trusting? Who are the people I'm relying on? Well, it's the people who built the application.
Sure.
It's the people who build all the libraries the application uses. It's the people who build the operating system services that the libraries sit on. It's the people who build the drivers that the operating system is sit on. That's a little different for me than it is for you, because your machine's a little different. It's a lot of people. How many of those people even work for Microsoft? Did this content even come from Microsoft? Well, yeah, the program I'm looking at came from Microsoft and a couple of contractors, right? But it depends on stuff that came from Tom's hardware card shop. Now, of the 400,000 or 500,000 people I just agreed to go naked in public in front of, how many of you think aren't going to pull out a digital camera? You got 500,000 people you're relying on, I promise you, you're making a mistake, because they're not all your friends. They may not even be out to get you. Let's assume they're all your friends. When was the last time you wrote an error-free program? Okay, good. Nobody's going to go for that. Rule of thumb, you get a 10-line program, you get at least one security bug. There's a famous case of a 25-line algorithm that somebody sketched an informal proof for. Over the subsequent 20 years, two or three different formal verifications were done of this algorithm. Each found bugs. Over a 20-year period, they found 18 bugs in a very carefully crafted 25-line algorithm. So those 500,000 people really could be diligent in trying to support you. The likelihood that you have a safe system out of that is closely approximating zero. In fact, if you can figure out how far down the first non-zero bit is in that number, you're a better person than I. We don't have machines big enough to represent how far down that first non-zero digit is. What can we do about it? So let's look at two possible assumptions. The first is, that it's possible to build programs that are right in principle. That's actually how we operate. If you ask people, hey, do people build bug-free programs, they say no. But if you look at the way people design systems and the assumptions and reliances they make on the programs, right, the assumptions are, well, I'm going to assume that this program is doing its job, and if it does, then I can rely on that.
Peter Lane, who's one of the people who worked on proof-carrying code, by way of trying to motivate proof-carrying code, attempted the following demo and was very surprised at the result. He took a Java program. And he wanted to show the power of the Java verifies. So he ran the program, showed what it did, brought the program up at Emacs, reached in, picked a byte at random in the program, and changed it. And tried to rerun the program in the expectation that the verifier would not accept the program. He had to change the program 5 times before he could get the verifier to reject the program. Most parts of a program are not safety critical. That's why we get away with our current programming practices. And I actually wish that we would do that experiment more. It would be very, very useful to collect data to understand actually how much of what we build is really critical. I suspect the answer is very, very low. I think we actually can, in principle, build correct programs if we're willing to go to absolutely extraordinary means, up to somewhere around 30,000 lines. Now, I'm talking about means where if we make 3 lines of progress a day, we're doing very well. At that level of excruciating care, we might be able to write programs that size. And we might not. There's a lot of arguments that nobody knows how to get above 10,000 lines. For sure, we're not going to write commercial applications that are going to be right out of the box. Not in your lifetime. Maybe not in the lifetime of computer science or the human race. Okay, so the second thing you can do is you can assume that programs are flawed. Now, this brings me to my second point about the difficulties of software. People say, oh, if I switched to Java, everything would be better. All those penetration attacks would go away. Sounds good, except that it's known to be contrary to fact. Gary McGraw, who runs a very successful business addressing security issues, has actually done a good study. And what he's learned is, if you look at the causes of security failure, you discover that 50% of them are bugs, errors in the code, errors of implementation. The penetration attack falls on the heads of bugs. Unfortunately, what you discover is that 50% of them are what he calls flaws. These are not exposures due to errors of implementation. They're exposures due to errors of design. So, the problem is that if we wipe out penetration attacks, all we do is we escalate the war up the food chain one level. And now, instead of sending your program arbitrary commands that I control, I'm going to send your program commands that it knows how to deal with in some fashion that it doesn't expect, that it's been miscoded to mishandle. Now, there is an important difference. A really important difference. It's not one that we can exploit productively on current systems. When I send your program a command that essentially excises your program, right? When I tell it, run something else, I've changed the contract. If I can get sendmail to give me a shell, I'm not in any sense restricted by what the code of sendmail is trying to do. Sendmail is gone. I'm not even restricted by the authority that sendmail had in the current system. Sendmail is gone. If I have to work within the rules of the program, if I can't get the program to get out of my way, if I have to work through the thing that the programmer built, there may be errors in the constraints that are imposed on me, but at least there are constraints. The program may act in a way that's surprising, but it cannot act in a way that exceeds its authority. And so if we can get out of this situation where people just bypass the program altogether, we actually can significantly reduce our exposures by analyzing the authority that's available to programs. Right? Even if the program has a mistake, you can't use more authority than it has. Okay, so this brings me to access control and protection. Traditional formulation of this problem is I have a machine with a bunch of what are called in literature subjects. There's some confusion in the literature about whether a subject meant a human or a process. Subject, in fact, always meant process. There was some misfortune in early literature, somebody was using the term. When we're talking about a human, we're talking about a principle. Let me tee off on the concept of a user ID for a second. Okay. What is a user ID?
It's an index of a table in the user file.
Sorry?
It's an index in the user file.
It is indeed an index in the user file. What do we generally assume it means when we look at user ID? What does UID do? What does it mean?
Identity.
Identity of what?
User.
That's the answer that everybody assumes is true, and that's the answer that's wrong. It's the identity of an entry in the user table, period, end of statement, stop, nothing more. It has only an accidental relationship to the user. A UID is merely a label of a set of things that are in some way associated with an entry in a file. And I mean, if you think about it, it can't be associated with the user. When was the last time you opened up the case of your computer and you found a user hiding in there? There are no users in computational systems. The user stands outside the box. Now, I don't know about you, look, the computer can call me all the names it wants, right? But it doesn't dictate my identity. It can assign me a number. That may or may not be an association that's valid from its point of view, but I don't care much. So in fact, what's really going on is a user ID is a set label. Okay, so what Unix calls a user ID is more generally called a principal ID. And I'm not going to have time to get into detail about what's a principal. And the reason I'm not very interested in it is by the time I'm done with tomorrow, you'll understand that it doesn't matter what a principal is. Alright, so the classic story on this is we're going to divide the system up into subjects and objects. Subjects are the things that invoke actions, processes. Objects are the things that actions are invoked on. So when I read a file, a subject is performing an action on an object. The subject is the process doing the read. The file is the thing that gets read. And since it turns out we can do operations on processes like stop them, kill them, get their registers, you actually have to extend this table so that the stuff across the top also includes all of the subjects. Okay. So the way this table is constructed, and this table is due to Butler-Lampson, is the goal is I want to draw a picture that captures who can do what in the system at a particular moment in time. And the way I'm going to do it is I'm going to go through all the subjects, I'm going to go through all the objects in the system. Obviously we're talking about a very small system. It's a nice mathematical model that we want to use it in practice. And what I'm going to write in the table is the permissions that each subject has on the corresponding object. could also think of this as a graph, where there's an arc from the subject to the object, with the head of the arrow pointed at the object, and each arc is decorated with the permissions that go on that arc. And that's actually a better picture. This is a traditional picture. It's also much easier to draw when you only have two dimensions to work. And so you can do some analysis on this graph that says, okay, what information can get where? Suppose S3 holds some information. Can it get to S1? The answer is yeah. S3 writes it to this object 3. S2 reads it. Excuse me, can't get to S1. Yes. S2 reads it from object 3 and copies it to object 1. Whereupon S1 reads it. Let me explain the analysis. So the model here is, we don't know anything about the behavior of the programs. So we're going to do a conservative analysis. We're going to assume if a program can do something, it will do something. We don't care what the actual program is. If in principle the process has the authority to take an action, we're going to assume that action might happen. So this is kind of a worst case analysis. With real software, worst case is a well-motivated analysis. So indeed, it's possible that S3 will write to O3, and it's possible that subsequently S2 will read there. And so you can see how the data can move from one place to another. There are two classic ways of actually encoding this graph. So this graph is actually used in some form to actually encode permissions in real systems. The first one is called an access control list. And the idea with an access control list is, off of every object, we're going to have a list of pairs. Which says, for some subject, there's some subset of access rights. So system-wide, we have a total list of access rights. Read, write, kill, things like that. So an actual example of this would be, let's take the one of the ones on the board. So for O3, S3 has write permission and S2 has read permission. Let me try to come at this another way. So another way to say this is, we have triples of the form SI, OJ, and some subset of rights. Oops, that was a poor word to write there. So I hope we agree that if we're writing a triple, rearranging the orders of the triple may change the data structure, but it doesn't change the meaning. So the access control list is the capture of the static state of the system in which we bundle things this way. So we're taking an object-centric perspective. All the information about access control hangs off the object. There's another classic way to do this, which is say, well, instead of bundling this way, which is the access control list way, you'll usually see that abbreviated ACL, ACL. Well, we could bundle it this way. So for, that's too much. Let me just do S3. We can attach the permissions to the processes. So this would say, subject 3 has write permission on object 3. And that would be the story in which we're going to pair things to the left of this tuple I've written down and hang them off of the remaining thing. Okay? This is just different factorings in this triple. And this pairing, the data structure, is the data structure of something called a capability. Now, we'll come back to this point tomorrow. But there's a key thing to see here. And it's something that the original paper acknowledges and almost no subsequent citation remembers. This picture does not tell us what's possible in the machine. It tells us the state of the machine at a frozen instant in time. And in order to understand what's possible in the machine, there are two things we need to know. We need to know what's the initial state of the machine. We need to know what are the rules by which the state can change. So in particular, in addition to data operations that move information from one place to another, there are operations that cause access rights to be added to or removed from the graph. If I create a file, that adds a new object. If I change the ownership of the file, that alters the permissions of the object. And it alters the associations of the object. So if we want to understand about policy, can we control information or access rights or something getting from here to there, what we have to ask is, well, what's the state we're going to start in? What are the things that could happen? And assuming those things happen, where can the information get in? So you'll see in the literature, including our textbook, I think, that a story that says that the rows, oh, be careful, depending on which literature you're reading, you'll either see objects and subjects across the top and subjects down the side, or sometimes you'll see the axes reversed. So don't hold me to the row column thing, pay attention to which table you're looking at. But you'll see it stated in the literature that basically if you took a row out of this table, that what you have is an axis control list entry. And that if you took a column out of this table, well, strictly speaking, not a row. If you took a row-wise pair, right, a subject and an object, you don't have an access control list there. If you take an entire row, you have an access control list. Right? If you take column-wise an object and a permission, you have the representation of a capability. Take an entire column, you have a capability list. Might have gotten that backwards. Doesn't matter. There's a difference between having an access control list and understanding what an access control list means. Having an access control list tells you what's the snapshot of the system right now. Having an access control list based system generally includes assumptions about which operations can be formed that can alter the access controllers. Similarly, capability, the data structure, right? The story that says there's a slice in this table you can take, that's a correct story. But when you start talking about a capability system, it means more than just a data structure. It's a set of operations that people assume are part of the definition of the capability system. And the reason that matters, there's a question you'd really like to know about this graph. Because ultimately, the reason you're looking at this is you want to know if you can enforce a higher level policy. So one of the questions you'd like to know is, well, I can look at the graph and I can maybe see that right now my information can't flow in the way that I don't care about, that I'm concerned about. But of course, I have to ask how the graph is going to evolve. And how the graph evolves is a function of what permissions can get to where. That's what it means to evolve the graph. So in 1974, Harrison, Russell, and Olmed published a paper. It's a theory paper. It's a classic paper in the protection literature. And they asked the following question. It's called the safety problem. Given a graph, can I determine if some particular access right, pick one, on some particular object, pick one, can be acquired by some particular subject? More precisely, can I determine if that subject can get that access right on that object through evolution of the graph? Paper comes up with several very disturbing answers. One, this question is generally, in general case, is undecidable. We don't know. Two, there are some conditions explored on what it takes to push this problem from decidable to undecidable. The answers are depressing, and they include most of the features the current protection system is utterly reliable. Three, this problem is always decidable in the finite case. So the paper is remembered from the undecidability result, but that's actually not the important result. This problem is always decidable in the finite case, and since I haven't purchased an infinite-size computer lately, that's the case I care about. And finally, for seven particular protection systems that are modeled in the paper, which happen to include all of the ones that are commercially being shipped today, in the finite case, the answer is, you cannot prevent an access right from being acquired in those systems. So the answer is yes, you can decide, and no, you cannot control. That's not a flaw of implementation. It's a mathematical necessity from the definition of the operations. Windows cannot mathematically be fixed. Unix cannot mathematically be fixed. We only know one model in which the answer is decidable and you can control it, and that's the capability model. And there are only a very short list of systems working that model. Good. I'm going to come back to this tomorrow. The message I want you to take from this is a really hard set of problems, and we've mostly in the operative system field built on the wrong foundations. It's going to be very hard to undo that.